Are you stressed? Have restless nights? Racing thoughts? We've all been there. Imagine having a natural way to feel calmer, sleep better, and bring more balance into your day. That's exactly what CBD can do. And when it comes to CBD, nobody does it better than CBDFX. CBDFX has been around since 2014, and they're one of the most trusted CBD companies out there. Every product is made right here in the USA with organic hemp, no GMOs, no pesticides, and no harmful chemicals. Plus, everything is backed by third-party lab reports, so you know it's pure, safe, and effective. They've got something for everyone, from sleep gummies and tinctures to CBD capsules, topicals, and even CBD treats for your pets. So it's easy to find the perfect fit for you. Their products have become part of my daily routine, and honestly, they just help calm my nerves. Improving sleep has led to so many other benefits. I can think more clearly. I have more energy. The podcast is better, probably, I think it is. You tell me. I've spoken before about my personal favorite, the CBD and CBN night capsules for sleep, which help you fall asleep quickly and sleep soundly through the night. They contain CBN, cannabinoid, commonly known as the ultimate relaxation cannabinoid, and other natural sleep aids. They're vegan, gluten-free, and made with organic hemp. So whether you want calm, focus, better sleep, or just an overall wellness boost, CBDFX has something for you. And right now, our listeners can get 40% off of your first order with code HAUNTINGS at CBDFX.com. That's CBDFX.com. Use promo code HAUNTINGS and get 40% off today. Feel the difference with CBDFX. The holidays are almost here. And if you still have names in your list, don't panic. Uncommon Goods makes holiday shopping stress-free and joyful with thousands of one-of-a-kind gifts you can't find anywhere else. You'll discover presents that are meaningful and personal, never rushed or last minute. Uncommon Goods looks for products that are high quality, unique, and often handmade or made in the U.S. Many are crafted by independent artists or small businesses, so every gift feels special and thoughtfully chosen. Uncommon Goods has something for everyone, from moms and dads to kids and teens, from book lovers and sports fans to foodies, mixologists, gardeners, and even the morbid curious. So you'll find unforgettable gifts that are anything but ordinary. When you shop at Uncommon Goods, you're supporting artists and small independent businesses. Every purchase is a chance to choose something remarkable and feel good about where your money goes. And with every purchase you make at Uncommon Goods, they give $1 back to a nonprofit partner of your choice. They've donated more than $3.1 million to date. I bought my girlfriend this awesome handcrafted nightlight for her office, which I'm super excited to watch her unwrap. And don't worry, she doesn't listen to this show. Something about, like, she already hears enough about me talking about ghosts at breakfast or something. I don't know. So don't wait. Make this holiday the year you give something truly unforgettable. To get 15% off your next gift, go to uncommongoods.com/hauntings. That's uncommongoods.com/hauntings for 15% off. Don't miss out on this limited time offer. Uncommon Goods, we're all out of the ordinary.
After listening to the previous episode, it's likely obvious that the record of New England witchcraft cases showed an unsettling pattern about the accused. It mostly boiled down to, if you made enough people angry at you or if you had something other people wanted, you could probably expect to be accused of being a witch in New England during the 1600s. In far too many cases, events spun out of control, leading to accusations, trials, and even hangings. Many communities regretted their belief that the devil was at work in their town after the dust settled, but by then, it was too late. By the end of the 1600s, many began to question the legalities of the trials, but before New England's witch mania could be stopped, the events at Salem Village in Massachusetts occurred and became one of the most infamous incidents in American history. The witchcraft panic began in 1692 in Salem Village, which was about 40 miles from Boston. It was a rugged place with an adult population at the time of only about 215 people, but the place was troubled by family quarrels, jealousy, and hostility. When religious fanaticism was added to the mix, accusations of witchcraft soon followed. but not just in Salem. Most of us are familiar with the terror that occurred in Salem, so I'm only going to offer an overview here. But most don't know that another witchcraft outbreak was occurring at the same time, not far away, and that some of Salem's so-called afflicted girls were responsible for deaths in that community, too. Welcome to American Nightmares, the podcast dedicated to America's history of horror. Through sinister tales of murder, madness, mayhem, spirits, scandals, and sins, I'll be presenting the origins of American terror, with true accounts of frightening witches, mysterious monsters, haunted houses, death and dying, and stories of revenge and despair that have been torn from the pages of our haunted past. American Nightmares is written, performed, and produced by Troy Taylor. That's me. And we're beginning with the horror at the root of the stories that kept the early settlers huddled around the fire late into the night. We're beginning with the devil himself. This is episode 3 of American Nightmares. The events at Salem Village began at the home of Reverend Samuel Parris, a strict Puritan minister. In the Parris household lived the Reverend, his wife, his 9-year-old daughter Elizabeth, and his 11-year-old niece, Abigail Williams. Parris had lived in Barbados for a time and had brought 2 slaves to Salem with him, John, who did outside work, and his wife, Tituba. She cooked, cleaned, and cared for the children. The girls were always entertained with Tituba's stories about her island home, its culture, and its magic. She showed the girls how to tell fortunes and read palms. There was nothing evil about it. It was meant to be all in fun, but as with so many other things, started with the best of intentions, it turned ugly. Elizabeth and Abigail were proud of their secret knowledge, and they boasted about it to some of their older friends, like Mary Walcott, Elizabeth Booth, Susanna Sheldon, and others, including Ann Putnam. Those other girls joined Elizabeth and Abigail for stories and demonstrations of fortune-telling. Now, what caused the girls to do what they did next remains up for debate, but they likely thought their pranks were harmless, but they wouldn't stay harmless for long. Elizabeth and Abigail began pretending to be bothered by strange twitches and fits, which caused them to roll around on the floor and froth at the mouth. Reverend Parris and his wife quickly summoned the village doctor for his advice, but since nothing like what we consider medicine was being practiced in those days, he had no idea what was wrong with them. To everyone else in the village, though, it was clear the children were victims of witchcraft. Elizabeth and Abigail's symptoms became worse. They cried out loud, they became dizzy and fell down. They crawled around on their hands and knees and made animal sounds. Village adults prayed for them, but it did no good. In fact, things spread to the other girls, and it appeared they had been hexed too. They imitated the faces, the sounds, and the contortions of Elizabeth and Abigail. As more people started talking about witchcraft, the girls began to be asked who had bewitched them. At first, no one could get a straight answer out of them. I mean, it had all started as a practical joke, after all. But now, it had become frightening. The village was taking it seriously, and if the girls stopped now and confessed, they would be severely punished. They became increasingly frightened. It was too late to turn back. They had to accuse someone of being a witch, so they did. Well, not one person, but 3. They claimed that Tituba, Sarah Good, and Sarah Osborne were the witches who were responsible for their suffering. Tituba had started it all with her magic and conjuring, and since she was also a woman of color, she was an easy target. Sarah Good was a poor woman who relied on the generosity of the community for herself and her children. Sarah Osborne was a mentally challenged woman with a hint of some sexual scandal in her past. Again, an easy target for the Puritans. Warrants were issued for the arrest of the three women, and they were taken before local magistrates. While the accused were being questioned, the girls they had supposedly bewitched fell to the floor, convulsing and screaming in pain. No other evidence was needed. These three women were obviously witches. But only Tituba confessed to being a witch, likely hoping it would save her. She said she'd made a pact with the devil to sell her soul in exchange for magical powers, and when she wrote her name in the devil's book, she saw other marks there, which meant there were more witches in the village. The authorities became determined to find them, which began the hysteria that gripped the village. More than a dozen people soon came forward, claiming they'd seen other people in the village sticking pens into dolls, cursing people, and dancing in the woods with the devil. And that was when the arrests began. Rebecca Nurse, a respected older woman, was dragged from her sickbed and charged as a witch. A farmer named John Proctor dared to declare that the girls were liars and they were pretending to be cursed to draw attention to themselves. His declarations resulted in his arrest for witchcraft, and his property was confiscated. When Martha Corey was accused, villagers were shocked. She was an upstanding member of the church, but when the hysteria gripped the community, she and her husband Giles were skeptical of the witchcraft claims and refused to take part in the hearings. That was enough to make them look suspicious. Martha was arrested first, and when she was taken before the magistrates, she denied that she'd bewitched anyone. But the afflicted girls, as they were now being called, began to scream, claiming they'd seen Martha Corey and another woman invoking the devil. Martha protested, but the girls were so convincing to the magistrates that Martha, and soon her husband Giles too, joined the other accused villagers in jail. More arrests were made, including that of Dorcas Good, the 5-year-old daughter of accused witch Sarah Good. When the magistrates discovered a small blister on the little girl's hand, they decided that was proof that Dorcas was a witch too, and she was forced to join her mother in jail. But at the same time this was happening in Salem Village, disturbances were also happening in the nearby village of Andover, located about 15 miles to the northwest. The town's atmosphere at the time was charged with the fear of the unknown and political upheaval. Two local ministers had split the town with differing ideologies, and there had been Native American raids in nearby Haverhill. And of course, there was the constant terror caused by the devil, who prowled the forests and fields around town. And when a middle-aged woman in Andover became gravely ill, the witchcraft hysteria from Salem Village literally arrived in town. Her husband suspected witchcraft was the cause, and he invited some of the afflicted girls from Salem to town, thinking they could determine whether his beliefs were valid. Well, not surprisingly, they confirmed his suspicions, touching off a wave of accusations, confessions, and formal charges. The first to be accused was Martha Carrier, a strong-minded woman known for freely speaking her mind. Since this was not a trait admired by the Puritans, it's no surprise she was accused of witchcraft by her neighbor, Benjamin Abbott, after they had an argument that involved a land dispute. After the disagreement, Abbott became sick and he blamed his illness on Martha bewitching him and would later testify that she had killed one of his cows through the devil's magic, of course. On May 28, 1692, Martha, along with her sister and brother-in-law, Mary and Roger Toothaker, and their 9-year-old daughter, Margaret, were arrested and charged with witchcraft. Martha was examined by magistrates 3 days later, and testifying against her were some of the afflicted girls from Salem, including Susanna Sheldon, Mary Walcott, Elizabeth Hubbard, and Ann Putnam. She pled not guilty and accused the girls of lying, but Martha's youngest children were also coerced into testifying against their mother. Martha's older children, who ranged in age from 18 to 8, were also accused. Though her children would survive, Martha would not be so lucky. She was pronounced guilty on August 2nd and hanged on August 19th, the same day that other hangings were taking place in Salem. In July, a young Andover man named Timothy Swan became ill and accused several women, including Mary Parker, Mary Bridges, Rebecca Eames, and Frances Hutchins, of bewitching him. He was joined in his accusations by two of the afflicted girls, Ann Putnam and Mary Alcott, who by now were acting almost as expert witnesses in courtrooms in two different towns. As it did in Salem, hysteria spread in Andover, and between July 15th and September 7th, more than 30 arrest warrants were issued against local residents who'd allegedly committed the crime of witchcraft. And that number would soon grow. Meanwhile, back in Salem, more people had been jailed, including John Proctor's wife, Elizabeth, and Rebecca Nurse's sister, Sarah Cloyce. Sarah had been understandably upset by the accusations made against her sister, and when, during a church service, Reverend Paris made a biblical reference that implied Rebecca was in league with the devil, Sarah became angry and left the meeting house, slamming the door shut behind her. It was soon decided she must be a witch too. At her hearing, the afflicted girls told the magistrates they'd witnessed ceremonies attended by Rebecca, Sarah, and other witches during which the devil had appeared. Sarah collapsed when this was said, and the girls mocked her by collapsing on the floor also, pretending to cry. This was their latest trick, trying to unsettle the prisoners by imitating them. If the accused continued to deny the charges against them, the girls went into a frenzy, howling and throwing themselves on the floor until the magistrates sent the prisoners to jail. Their behavior affected everything that went on in court, and it also terrified the villagers. They were afraid of being accused themselves, and many left town, hoping that would save them. But there were more arrests and more accusations. When Bridget Bishop and Giles Corey were questioned, both insisted they were innocent, but as soon as the afflicted girl started screaming, both were sent to jail. Another person arrested was Abigail Hobbs, who just decided to confess to everything. She told the magistrates that she practiced witchcraft, attended gatherings with sorcerers, and had made a pact with the devil in which she, quote, sold herself body and soul to the old boy. She was jailed along with the others, but during her confession, she named 9 more people as witches, including her own parents. Rattled and overwhelmed when she was arrested, Abigail's mother, Deliverance, became as unhinged as her daughter was. She also confessed to practicing witchcraft and offered the names of other witches in the village. Her husband, William, claimed that he was innocent of all charges, which, of course, just landed him in jail. Another of the accused, Susanna Martin, failed to take the courtroom proceedings seriously. She laughed at the behavior of the afflicted girls and called them liars. She was taken to jail anyway, but she'd so impressed the officials that they started to believe that, hey, maybe she wasn't guilty. So they let her out of jail, but not for long. Whether genuinely fearful or just malicious, the afflicted girls became hysterical. When they accused Susanna again, she found herself back behind bars. When the wife of Andover resident Joseph Ballard fell sick that summer, it was believed her illness was caused by witchcraft, but it took two of the afflicted girls to verify it. After Ann Putnam and Mary Walcott visited Elizabeth Ballard, the girls claimed that several people in Andover had bewitched her, including Ann Foster, her daughter, Mary Lacey, her granddaughter, and numerous others. The Ballards sought help from Reverend Thomas Barnard, a follower of Puritan minister Cotton Mather. Both Barnard and Mather wholeheartedly believed in witchcraft and were convinced that the devil was threatening all the good people of the Massachusetts Bay Colony. However, this belief was not shared by Barnard's assistant pastor, Reverend Francis Dane, who had condemned the witch hunt from the beginning. However, Barnard cared little about Dane's opinions and had been instrumental in spreading the witchcraft hysteria and holding prayer meetings against the devil. On September 7, 1692, Barnard ordered all those accused of witchcraft to come together at the Andover Meeting House, where the two afflicted girls would be waiting. Once the accused had all gathered, he conducted a test to determine whether they were actually witches. Now, at that time, it was believed that if a witch's hand touched the body of a person who had been bewitched, that person would immediately become well and could identify the witch. After reciting a prayer, Barnard then blindfolded the accused one by one. They were then forced to approach the afflicted girls, who were weeping, crying out, and falling into fits as the accused got closer. When they touched them, the girls seemed to be immediately cured, and this identified the person touching them as a witch. This was considered strong evidence against accused witches in those days. After one witch after another was identified, the magistrate dutifully wrote out arrest warrants for 18 men and women, including Sarah Wilson, her 14-year-old daughter, Mary Taylor, and her daughter, Abigail Barker, and many others. And while this was happening, chaos was continuing to reign in Salem Village, too. A new royal governor, Sir William Phipps, had recently arrived from England, but had little interest in what was happening in Salem. He was only interested in getting together a military expedition against the French in Canada. He passed through Salem Village on his way to battle and was approached by those who had relatives who'd been jailed as witches. Well, he didn't do much to help. He said the accused would have to stand trial. That was how things worked. But he did speed things up a bit by forming a special court and naming Deputy Governor William Staunton as its president. He appointed six judges to hear the witchcraft cases. Now the accused were no longer just being questioned. They were going on trial. And once that happened, Sir William was convinced that all would be allowed to go free. He never imagined that anyone could prove the accused women and men were witches. Boy, did he really get that one wrong. Bridget Bishop was the first to be brought before the judges. She was everything the Puritans hated about women. She was twice widowed and ran a successful local inn. She also stood out in the community because she wore brightly colored clothing. When the women assigned by the court examined Bridget's body, they found a blemish believed to be a devil's mark, and of course she didn't help herself by claiming she was innocent. Bridget was pronounced guilty and hanged on June the 10th. During the trials that followed, the insanity in the village peaked when the judges began allowing spectral evidence to be admitted in court. This evidence claimed that apparitions of witches had been sent to attack and torment innocent people in town. Now, these weren't the actual witches, but ghost versions of themselves who were doing their dirty work. Conveniently, these specters could only be seen by those who were bewitched. Now, it seems mind-boggling to us today that the judges would allow this insanity to be heard as evidence, but in Puritan-led New England at the time, well, it seemed perfectly reasonable. In late June, Sarah Good, Elizabeth Howe, Susanna Martin, Sarah Wilds, and Rebecca Nurse were all placed on trial. All of them but Rebecca were found guilty and sentenced to hang. Rebecca's good reputation initially saved her life. Her friends and family were brave enough to testify on her behalf, and charges against her were dismissed. Until the courtroom suddenly erupted. The afflicted girls howled, pulled their hair, and rolled around on the floor, screaming that Rebecca was guilty. Unbelievably, the verdict was reversed, and she was found guilty this time. And on Tuesday, July 19th, this woman who'd once been set free was hanged with the other women who'd also been charged. In early August, John and Elizabeth Proctor stood trial, along with four others. All were found guilty. Only Elizabeth was spared from being hanged. She was pregnant at the time, and under Puritan law, the killing of her innocent unborn child was forbidden. George Jacobs was accused because of his granddaughter, Margaret. She accused him of being a witch because she feared being tortured and hanged. She would name anyone she could think of. Although she later swore in court that her confession had been coerced and that her testimony had been false and untrue, it didn't change anything. George was found guilty and sentenced to hang. In September, 15 more people were sentenced to death. On September 22nd alone, 8 were hanged, including Martha Corey. Several of those who'd been convicted pleaded to the judges and the clergy for clemency, but no one was brave enough to try and help them. When Giles Corey was brought to trial, he knew that if he claimed to be innocent, which he was, he'd be convicted anyway. Refusing to lie and plead guilty just to save his life, he refused to enter a plea at all. Under Puritan law, this meant he could not be brought to trial. But he paid the price for his silence. Heavy stones were placed on the old man while the authorities demanded that he confess. Well, he didn't, and they eventually crushed him to death, although it took 2 days for the weight of the stones to finally kill him. As he lay there, slowly dying, the people of the village were deeply affected by his courage, and the death of Giles Corey became a turning point in the witch trials. People in Salem were finally starting to have some doubts about what was happening. Following the death sentences of September, the court recessed with plans to reconvene later in the fall, but it never did. Doubts among some members of the village caused a few to speak out, and soon, prominent people from as far away as Boston began to question the fairness and legality of the trials. But it was Governor Phipps who finally put the whole thing to an end. He returned from the Canadian border and was shocked to find that more than 150 people were still chained up in jail, waiting to be put on trial for witchcraft. He was angry his special court hadn't solved the problem. Instead, it had made things worse. He ordered that no one else would be jailed, and decreed that in the future, spectral evidence would be inadmissible in his courts. This made convicting those still in jail impossible, and all of them were released. The Salem witch trials finally came to an end, and soon, so did the trials in Andover. Many in Andover were stunned by the number of accusations and arrest warrants, but listened to officials of the church who urged those accused to just simply confess. They believed the message preached by Reverend Barnard that confession was the only way to salvation. And boy, confess they did, hoping the stories they concocted would keep them from being tried and executed. However, once numerous wives and children were in prison, church leaders began to realize they'd been deceived by the fanaticism of their minister, Thomas Barnard. Finally, realizing the full implications of what was happening, they turned to Reverend Dane and formed a resistance movement of sorts. Under his guidance, they began taking the steps required to free those who'd been imprisoned. This helped public opinion to turn against the trials and bring the madness to an end. More than 40 Andover residents, mostly women and children, had been formally accused of having made a pact with the devil. 3 people, Martha Carrier, Mary Eyre Parker, and Samuel Wardwell, were convicted and executed. 5 more either pled guilty at arraignment or were convicted at trial. Those who were not executed were later granted a reprieve by Governor Phipps. But unfortunately, one woman, Ann Foster, died in jail before she could be released. Of course, both the number of arrests and the death toll in Salem were much higher, and bitterness lingered in the village for years after the trials and hangings. In all, 20 innocents went to their deaths. Dozens were jailed. Of those accused, 50 confessed to being witches, likely under the threat of torture and abuse. Several died in jail, probably from the poor conditions. And then there was little Dorcas Good, the 5-year-old sent to jail as a witch. She nearly went insane from her experience and the trauma caused by it, and she never recovered. The witchcraft hysteria had ended friendships, torn apart families, and many of those who fled Salem during the hysteria never returned. The afflicted girls never explained what led them to do what they did. And of all of them, only Ann Putnam ever apologized for her actions. But I'm not sure anyone really forgave her. The community was so angry with Reverend Paris for demanding the children accuse others of bewitching them that he and his family were forced to leave the village. Many of those who led the hunt for witches in the area had regrets. They admitted their mistakes, apologized, and begged for forgiveness, but no apologies could erase the damage that had been done. Over the last three centuries, historians have pondered the cause of the Salem witch panic. They have blamed fraud, family conflict, sexual repression, accidental poisoning, and hysteria. But these worries about only Salem are pointless. It may be the best known story of witchcraft in New England, but it's not the only place that it happened, as proven by the almost identical events at Andover that were happening at the same time. The people of Andover had their own problems and issues, but the one thing the community had in common was Salem Village, was a religious extremism and the hysteria created by it. The people's overpowering fear of the devil and his works, stoked by local Puritan ministers, was undoubtedly the reason for the events at Salem, Andover, and in other towns and villages across New England where panics over witchcraft occurred in the 1600s. What happened during those years turned the American colonies into a terrifying place for nearly a century. And it changed how we thought about witchcraft and the devil, and why we should be afraid of both, in a way that endures to this day. Thanks for listening to this episode of American Nightmares, which is part of the American Hauntings Podcast Network. This episode was written, performed, and produced by Troy Taylor for American Hauntings. If you like the show, we hope you'll consider checking out some of the books, events, and other great happenings that we have coming up. In addition to a few dinner events still available in 2025, we've just posted new events for the upcoming winter and spring. And you can join me over this spooky winter season for tours and events at the American Oddities Museum in Alton, Illinois. We've got pub crawls and dinner tours, a special speakeasy night, favorite dinner events like the St. Louis Exorcism, H.H. Holmes, the Limp Family, Abraham Lincoln, American Axe Murders. Plus, we have new events like American Murder Houses, Public Enemies, Haunted Battlefields, and more. You can and should make reservations now by going to dinnerandspirits.com. And coming sooner than we think is the annual Dead of Winter event on February 7th. Join us for the free daytime event at Franklin Lodge in Alton, Illinois, featuring speakers and presenters on ghosts and hauntings. All you need to do to get in is bring a food donation or non-perishable item that will go to area food banks. We also have ticketed after-hour events at night, including a St. Louis Exorcism dinner, a Black Mirror workshop, and a ghost hunt at Franklin Lodge. It's our 26th annual food drive, and we don't want you to miss it. And finally, be sure to check out the website for the 2026 Haunted America Conference. It's now up and running and features this year's roster of speakers and presenters, after-hours events, tours, ghost hunts, workshops, and everything else you need to know. On December 8th, vendor spaces for 2026 go on sale, and they always get snapped up quickly. So if you're planning to have a booth this year, you don't want to wait too long to get that booked. General admission tickets for the conference will go on sale starting January 12th. And with that, I'd like to say thanks again for checking out the latest episode of the podcast. I hope you loved it, and if you did, please share it with friends, people you work with, anyone you think would love it too. As a thank you, we've got a discount code that's just one word, podcast. And that gives you 10% off any books, tours, or events you purchase from our online store. Because, well, we're more than just this podcast and all the other podcasts that we've been doing. We're also books, tours, ghost hunts, dinner events, the Haunted America Conference, and the American Oddities Museum in Alton, Illinois. You can find everything about us on the website, AmericanHauntings.net. Stay tuned for the next episode of American Nightmares and let us know what you think of it by leaving a review or texting a comment to the hotline at 217-791-7859. We appreciate your continued support for every aspect of American Hauntings, and we couldn't and definitely wouldn't do this without all of you. And your comments and feedback, well, they mean a lot to us. So good night, good luck, and I will see you next time. Just be sure that the devil doesn't get you first.